The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
We have made it from start. 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting for 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, listeners. Welcome to the Sunday Open Line Show, and this is August 19th, 2018. Thank you very much for tuning in. I am your host, David Livingston. Hopefully, I'll guide you through the next 90 minutes to 2 hours on subjects and topics that primarily you want to talk about more than what I may suggest. But we will start out with my suggesting a few topics. So a couple of things before the opening announcements. First of all, the toll-free line is turned off at the moment, and that's so I can get through the first part of introductions and my suggested topics. Number two, the only program this week is tomorrow, and it is with Brent Sherwood and two other co-workers of his at JPL. I believe, but I'm not 100% sure because the topic might have migrated, that it's about LOPG and using it for an artificial gravity platform and a couple of other things. This is because Brent, who has been on the show many times, and I go way back with him, and he's a friend, and he's a Yale graduate space architect for real, wrote a thing in one of the AIAA publications about how to use LOPG for a artificial gravity platform and a couple of other things. So knowing how much love and real affection the Space Show audience has for LOPG, I thought I would ask Brent to come on the program and discuss what he presented to AIAA. And he came back and wanted two other guests with him on the show, which I don't like. As you all know, I'm not a fan of multiple guests on the Space Show, maybe sometime in the future. I can tell you why, in my opinion, multiple guests do not typically work. Anyway, I was not listened to, and being the tough, firm, no-nonsense, draw-a-line-in-the-sand guy that I am, we have three guests on the show tomorrow. So now, after that, I'm headed to Pasadena for the Mars Society Conference. And I will be there all week, and there will be no programs, no Hotel Mars, no Space Show programs. And I will be at the Mars Society gig on Thursday evening. On Friday, I am getting in the Camry and heading down to Cal State Fullerton, where I have an appointment with Dr. Heidi Fern and Dr. Jim Woodward, and I'm doing an update with them on mock thrusters. So first of all, I really, really like Jim and Heidi. They're great, and they have been absolutely amazing supporters of the Space Show with their time and their information. And, you know, we all like advanced propulsion topics, and mock thrusters have grabbed the attention of many of us, and Jim has recently got a ton of funding from NASA NIAC and some other organizations. I understand when I am there, their lab will have been renovated, and it needs it. Believe me, there's hardly enough room to walk in it. I'm anxious to see how they've done it and how the software and the research tools have been upgraded. That's more important than having space there. And the treat for all of this is that Dr. Brandenburg, is now in Fullerton, California, where Cal State is, and he is working with Jim and Heidi. So Dr. B is going to be our Space Show sort of narrative, help to understand guest, because he does have a really good knack of explaining things for Space Show listeners that we can understand, even if we might disagree with him. But so my meeting on Friday, which I will tape, assuming all the tape recorders I bring work, will then be processed and archived as a Space Show archive program. I doubt that I will be able to do it for one of the shows that I'm missing this week, because I'm not sure that I can do it on my laptops. And the following weekend is a Labor Day holiday in the United States, and I don't normally do programs on Labor Day holiday. So I think any recordings I make from the Mars Society or from Woodward's lab will be archived and put up on the days that we're not doing live shows during Labor Day holiday weekend, which would be Sunday and Monday coming up. I will also be at the Mars Society for part of Saturday, and then I move over to Hollywood to be a dad and see my son and Toaster, his pooch, and his friend Amanda and some other people. And I will not be at the Mars Society gig on Sunday, which is their final day. And then I am back on Monday, and we resume Space Show programming on Tuesday with Dr. Robert Hoyt of Tethers Unlimited. So all of these shows are posted now, and these holiday days are posted on upcoming show menu on the Space Show website. So if anything changes, I will be updating the Space Show website, not necessarily the email or the website newsletter. So that's a heads up for everybody. Our toll-free number for today is 1-866-687-7223. No call screeners. Just be patient. We'll get you up on the phone as quickly as possible. And I will let you know when I turn the toll-free number back on. If you do go to our website, thespaceshow.com, our full newsletter will be uploaded shortly after today's program, sometime this afternoon or early this evening. Remember, everything we do is archived. You can listen right off the site or quickly download it. And check out our store, and it's in the upper left menu under support. There's also the Listen Live button, and please share this information. So this tells you how to listen to live programs, our podcast on the various different servers, Alexa, which has the TuneIn player embedded there. TuneIn, by the way, is also a podcast player, and we're listed there as well. And then compressed MP3s that are the archive format on our website. To me, as always, the most important information on our website is supporting the Space Show. So I say this all the time, and I don't get very many responses to it. It's very frustrating. But the Space Show is pretty expensive to produce, everybody, and whether you believe that or not, I don't know what to say. If you were out in Petaluma and you absolutely twisted my arm for a tour to see how and why it's expensive to produce in my home office, I'd probably do it. I'd probably invite you over and serve you a hot drink, as Sheldon Cooper likes to say. And, you could see the hardware and what it takes to produce this and the personnel that do it. But this is an expensive show to produce, and that is because we're putting in live telephone lines into the mix. If all we were doing was recording calls and it wasn't a live show, it'd be a slam dunk. But that's not what we're doing. So we have lots and lots of equipment. It's mostly all analog equipment. And it's a listener-funded show. We're a 501c3 nonprofit with OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. And frankly, we need your support to keep going. And many of you love the show. I get your emails all the time, yet you don't support the show. So what's up with that? If you like the show, come on, step forward, help support it. So if you pay U.S. federal taxes, given that we're a 501c3, you do get a tax deduction for your gift. If you're a California taxpayer, you get a California tax deduction as well. You can learn more about the OneGiantLeapFoundation.org, 501c3. That's our parent at that website. OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. And if you have questions, certainly feel free to ask me. Email is always best, drspace, drspace, at thespaceshow.com. And you can also support us through your routine or even special Amazon purchases. You'll see a big Amazon block in the center of our homepage. And Amazon has two fabulous programs in the United States. This recently came up with a listener in the UK. But the Amazon programs are for the U.S. only because they pertain to our tax laws. But if you click on our Amazon link, it'll give you the information about our portal, which you can use, and you sign in to your account through our portal, or the Smile site, which is a clone of the regular site, but you register the nonprofit of your choice, which would be OneGiantLeapFoundation.org. And then in both programs, Amazon donates a percentage of your purchase price to the Space Show. Great ways to support the program, just with normal Amazon purchases that you do every day and every evening. So if you're not doing that, we'd certainly appreciate your support that way as well. You'll find PayPal information on our homepage, center right, if you would like to support us with a contribution through PayPal. And the same link will also tell you how to address a check, which goes to 1ONEGiantLeapFoundation.org, and the mailing address if you don't want to use electronics and you want to send us a paper check. We tell you how to do that as well. So we really do appreciate your support. It does help keep us going, and it keeps inspiring us to do more and encouraging us. So I cannot stress enough how important your support is. I could do a whole 90 minutes on how important your support is, and I probably would not do the topic justice. So if you enjoy the show, if you like our guest, if you like interacting with our guest, if you like our blog, then, you know, step forward and support us and help us to continue going. And we truly, truly do appreciate your support. It is very, very meaningful to us, okay? We also have sponsors, and the sponsors get their banner ad going across our homepage. You'll see them alternating as they go across our homepage. You can change those banner ads as often as you like. And I also read a short statement from each sponsor on a full-length program, which is what this program is today. On shorter programs, I just name the sponsors and thank them. But for the first segment today, Northrop Grumman is our sponsor. They're a leading global security company providing innovative systems, products, and solutions for both the commercial customers and government worldwide. And their capabilities go from undersea to outer space and include cyberspace. The Space Foundation at spacefoundation.org is our sponsor. Right now they have the annual space report listed on their website. Check it out. This is sort of the economic progress report of both the public and the commercial space sector. Really, really an important document. So again, spacefoundation.org, and we certainly appreciate their support. The Space Development Network is our sponsor. This is an online organization that allows you to join together with others to advance the plan for space development, specifically space settlement. And they're looking for people with a wide variety of interest and skills. It's a free network to join, and I urge you to check it out at spacedevelopment.org. And then the National Space Society is our sponsor. So this group not only does ISDC around Memorial Day every year, which is a terrific conference that many of you participate in and attend, but it also has study groups and other programs like the one coming up on space settlement, most of which are very important and near to the heart of Space Show listeners. So they have a new website address, although the old website address will still take you to their website, but it is now space.nss.org. Let me repeat that, space.nss.com. And we appreciate their support as well. The sponsors for the second part of the show I will read in the second segment. So in terms of my suggesting topics to all of you to discuss, I'm going to do so, even though for the most part you guys usually ignore them. But a couple of the topics, there was a really interesting article about, and I'm not going to tell you much, so if you want to know more about it, look it up real quick on Google and bring it up on the show and we can talk about it. How Mary G., the initial G., Ross, helped pave the way for interplanetary space travel. And I bring this up because Mary G. Ross was an Oklahoman, and as everybody knows, both the caller Marshall and I are Okies. I'm from Tulsa, and Marshall likes to say when he's calling he's from Nowheresville, Oklahoma. But anyway, you might be intrigued by this article, how Mary G. Ross helped pave the way for interplanetary space travel. If this intrigues you and you want to use it as a discussion topic today, hey, call. Let's talk about it. Okay, a Popular Mechanics article appeared. NASA approves the SpaceX load-and-go fueling for astronaut flights. So load-and-go means that the astronauts climb on board and they finish loading the compressed extra cold fuel while the astronauts on board. It's pretty much unheard of because it's considered to be really dangerous. NASA has approved this SpaceX process, load and go. You might want to talk about that. And I'm sure you can find the article again, the headline, NASA approves SpaceX load, L-O-A-D, and go, fueling for astronaut flights. Then NASA did an SLS rocket engine test, and it got cut way short and was only tested for, I don't know, I think 25 seconds or 33 seconds, something like that, but deemed a success. Those of you who find SLS dear to your heart, either in terms of love or hate, you might want to talk about their recent engine test, why it was cut short, what does it really, really mean. And there have been a couple of series of articles that take you inside the Dragon spaceship and let you see what it's going to be look like for the astronauts inside. And there was recently one on the Orion, and Lockheed put it out, what it would be like going into deep space with Orion. NASA Administrator Bridenstine has come out showing 100% support for SLS and a manned lunar site, which is kind of strange because they're also in support of LOPG, which again, I believe the name has been changed to just the Gateway or the Lunar Gateway. So I guess officially LOPG didn't cut it. We have talked about the Space Force a few times. Maybe we need to talk about it more, and maybe you want to talk about it more. I know those of you that oppose it are usually the ones that talk about it. I don't hear a lot from those of you who support it, and I do believe there are those of you out there who do support it. But there have been a couple of new polls that have come out within the past couple of days. Ars Technica has printed them up on August 16th. Today's the 19th, so that's, what, 3 days ago. And the headline of the Ars Technica article, if you want to find it, is polls show little support for Trump's Space Force. So if you want to talk about the Space Force, we're up for it, okay? There was another opinion piece printed in CNN, also on the 16th, and I thank John Jossi for sending it to me. Billionaires reach for the stars while world suffers. So the implication is that all these fat cat billionaires are playing with space and spending their money to go to space, and everybody else on the planet is taking it up the shorts, so to speak. We're suffering. And it somehow paints the billionaires and these very, very rich people as evil. I mean, I think that's the implied message. But you can find it. Again, it's a CNN article. And the headline is Billionaires Reach for the Stars While World Suffers. And it's an opinion article. So if you want to talk about it, that's fine. Pull the article down and read it so you'll be familiar with it. Okay, there is another interesting article. I don't know if it's Space Force related, if it's being printed politically to maybe help say we need to get the Space Force away from the Air Force. There's always agendas with everything, so who knows what's what. But this is titled Air Force Vulnerability with Space Programs. This was on Friday, August 17th. So if you search for that headline, you can find it. And you may want to include that in your discussion of the Space Force if you want to talk about the Space Force. So another article appeared on the 17th, and I forget where it was, where the Space Force is certainly not popular at this time and will not happen without changes. Well, it's very unpopular right now in Congress. It needs Congress to come about. So, again, I didn't write down where the article came from, but it was Friday the 17th, and the headline, "The Space Force is certainly not popular at this time and will likely not happen without changes." So there's several articles that feed into the narrative of the Space Force if you want to talk about it. By the way, I have opened the toll-free line. It is available if you want to use it. And the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. One other topic which is kind of tender and sensitive to talk about, but I'm going to mention it in the context of SpaceX and SpaceX plans for Mars and rockets and other things, and that is the news articles indicating that Elon Musk is in the process of breaking down or having problems or under a lot of emotional stress, business stress, financial stress, specifically around Tesla more than anything else. But what effect do you think medical or emotional or maybe Securities and Exchange Commission legal problems that might befall on Mr. Musk might have on SpaceX and SpaceX plans, Dragon plans, for example, human spaceflight plans, BFR, going to Mars? Is SpaceX bulletproof from challenges and difficulties that may beset Mr. Musk? And make no mistake, I haven't talked to Elon in years, and I don't know anything about his condition other than what was recently reported on in a New York Times interview and other sources of information have been talking about. Plus, I am on the unsolicited, unwanted receiving end with about 100 other people, many of whose email addresses I receive, that have been violently and filthy in their language attacking Mr. Musk and a couple of other people. The attacks mostly are around Tesla. I'm sure Musk knows that these emails are going around, and they do have attachments to them. And they're really, really disgusting emails. And I have no way of getting off the list because the address that is sending them is spoofed. And I've Googled for the name on the person, but it's a handle name. So I don't even know where they're originating from, but I don't want them. And I'm deleting them as fast as they come in. But I've never seen anything like it. And then, of course, the New York Times does their interview the other day, and we've all probably been reading somewhat about that. And it appears that he is under an enormous amount of stress. So if we extrapolate some of this to SpaceX, should we be concerned? There's also rumors going around that Musk, and I don't believe he would do this, but that Musk might use SpaceX to help bail out Tesla. So let's for a minute assume that he was able to do that. How do you think that would affect SpaceX going forward and with all of the grandiose space vision, Mars vision plans, rocket vision plans for SpaceX, even the satellite plans that they have out of their Seattle satellite company? Would bailing out Tesla be a big deal for SpaceX? So those are some topics that I'm throwing out there. Of course, Open Line really is a show for you guys, and you can talk about anything you want that is science related, space related, STEM related, STEAM related. Let's not go political. Civility is required at all times. And again, the number, which is already busy, is 1-866-687-7223. And email is drspace@thespaceshow.com. And wouldn't you know it, who's going to be our first caller? I should make book on this. And I bet that I would win. It is that fellow Oki I mentioned, Marshall, and he is already on the phone with us. Hi, Marshall. Welcome to the Space Show for kicking us off. How are things in Nowheresville, Oklahoma today?
I'm sorry. That's Renfro, Oklahoma, metropolis of a whole 13 people.
So Renfro, is it on the map as Renfro or Nowheresville?
It's Renfro, but it's one of those towns that's so small that it doesn't have a post office, so, you know.
So it's smaller than Mayberry.
Mayberry would be big town. Anyway, you were talking about Elon, and I happen to have been watching a very interesting movie about a temperamental super engineer, kind of like Elon, called Howard Hughes. And I was noticing the relationship. Both extremely, rich, both extreme engineer types, and that's the kind of people, as much as the politicians may dislike it, is really needed in the world to move things forward. They take the big bets, they do the gambles, and they tend to win, and everybody ends up being better off.
Of course, Howard Hughes had some real fetishes, like, you know, being sick, bacteria, germs, you know,
yep.
Living in isolation, wearing gloves, you know, all sorts of things. And plus his spruce goose, I don't know if it was really built thinking that he would fly it or not. I mean, it did fly once to a hangar, you know, what,
yep.
A quarter mile away or something like that. But Musk flies what he builds.
Yeah, and so, you know, both of them have taken big chances on technology, and some of them work out, some of them don't. But in the aggregate, they end up being heroes in their own right.
Musk does not seem to me, I never knew Howard Hughes personally, but he certainly knew his way around the Hollywood starlet women program, and Musk certainly knows his way around navigating with young supermodels as well.
yep.
including some that are Hollywood types. He, you know, Howard had an airline. He had TWA. And, you know, they used aircrafts built by Lockheed and Boeing, I guess, at the time. Those were the main suppliers. But he was I think he was much weirder, and he's kind of an introvert in many ways because of his fetish for germs and living in that secluded thing on top of the desert. What was it, the Desert Inn in Las Vegas for 20 years or something like that, never going outside. Musk is social. Musk goes out. He gives interviews. He meets people. He travels.
Howard,
not in seclusion.
Yeah, Howard went up and testified before Congress and went out in the big movie premieres and so on like that. You know, he pulls it in. Howard pulled it in and, you know, did the presentations and so on. And after the... what was the name of that spy plane they built? FX-11 spy aircraft that he crashed. He was almost killed right there. So the added 30 years he had after that, you know, it's kind of like, well, once you're broken, and, you know, and that's kind of the way I feel. It's kind of like, I got put out to pasture.
So you think they're similar, and
Well, there's a a lot of similarities, and obviously there's a lot of big differences. If nothing else, Howard Hughes was in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. Hopefully, Elon's going to have a 30 or 40-year career of engineering success also.
Well, he's already had a lot of engineering success, and you know, and he's already in the history books, you know, for that matter. And he is a personality, and he is a character like Howard Hughes. And I don't think, no matter what happens to him, that's ever going to change. Do you think that any of this is a risk for SpaceX? I mean, that's kind of our concern here. We want to see SpaceX.
If he properly. He should have extremely good lawyers, and the way the different companies are structured, et cetera, et cetera. They should be totally independent of each other, to where the failure of one doesn't cause a problem with a failure of the other. And let's see. I haven't checked that in a long time, but he had a... He was one of the major people that produced PayPal, which is where he made most of his early money. So I don't know how much of that he still holds, but that should be, you know, a totally separate bank account.
Actually, there's a really good website history of PayPal and the people that did this. I mentioned it on an open line show several months ago. And it's under a guy on YouTube, and again, I thank John Jossi for this information, called Neoscribe, N-E-O-S-C-R-I-B-E. And this is about I think it's around a 20 or 30 minute video that he put together on the history of PayPal and the people that made it happen. And it is an eye-opener, and it's one of the best things I have seen in a long time. So I would urge anyone interested in how Elon and a lot of the other players that you hear about in Silicon Valley all the time, Peter Thiel and some of the others who are now partners with Elon, how they made their money and got started and what they did with PayPal. And PayPal had competition, and how they beat out the competition that was actually more advanced than PayPal at the time when all of this was going on. It's a fascinating story. And again, if you go to YouTube, the guy's channel is called Neoscribe, N-E-O-S-C-R-I-B-E. He does exceptional work. A lot of stuff is on space. I mean, it's really, really good. He's got a new one up artificial intelligence and other kinds of things like that. But you'll find the one on the history of PayPal. I forget what it's called. It's really worth your time to go watch it. Very educational, and he uses charts and graphs, and he documents his homework really well. And I'd urge people to do it. But Marshall, you're the first person I have ever heard that has made a comparison between Howard Hughes and Elon Musk.
Yeah, well, you might be able to twiddle a little bit further back in history to Isaac Newton. Isaac had a few quirks of his own that were a little weird. On the other hand, Isaac was a genius. And we're all better off because of Isaac Newton.
Well, I think all of these people, you know, have some quirks and things, you know.
Oh.
Otherwise, they probably wouldn't be accomplishing what they did.
Yeah. I just thought of another person, Goddard.
Yeah.
Goddard was a total loner. And he made fantastic strides, and he did most of his work, you know, as most of the reports on his work were theoretical physics papers, which, you know, very good on math. And he did not go off into the fantasy stuff at all, which is an interesting point, too. But these people come up in history, and we should be a little nicer to them, I think.
Well, I think, you know, the space supporters and SpaceX folks are pretty nice overall to Musk. I don't think, you know, but Musk steps in it, kind of like someone else who's always in the news. And, you know, he declared war on short sellers for Tesla, and that may... get him in a lot of trouble for stock manipulation with statements he made that helped the short sellers lose a ton of money. I guess Twitter is a great tool, but it's also, you know, it gets a lot of people in trouble. So
if the president can do it, Elon should be able to.
Well, and he does, and both of them profess that they're not giving up Twitter. So maybe that's a show in itself, the perils of undisciplined tweets. Listen, anything else? Maybe somebody else will want to call in and compare Mr. Musk to somebody else, or comment on your comparison with Howard Hughes. I'm sure we'll talk about that some more on the space show. I'm glad you offered that up to us.
Okay, well, let's let somebody else put in their two cents.
Thank you, Marshall. I appreciate
Bye.
Your call. So, listeners, Marshall has hung up on himself, so to speak. And hopefully more of you out there want to use the toll-free line. It is 1-866-687-7223. And you can have your own topic. You don't have to use any of my suggested topics. And you don't have to talk about Howard Hughes either with Marshall's topic. So anything that is on your mind, we would like to hear from you about it. I do have an interest in the Space Force, but that may not be much of an interest to all of you. Let's see who's on the line now. Good afternoon, listeners. Welcome to the Space Show. Who are you, please, and thank you for calling us.
Are you... David, this is John Josie in Fremont.
Oh, the guy who sends me really cool stuff. Thank you very much, John.
You're welcome. Yeah, no, I have another one regarding the Space Force, and I don't know if you saw Paul Spoudis's recent article in Aerospace America.
No, I usually get his emails on it, but I don't remember seeing that he wrote anything on the Space Force.
So he's making an argument that the creation of the Space Force is in harmony with NASA going back to the moon. And what I was looking for in the article, I was looking for, you know, is he in favor of a Space Force or not? And he doesn't really hit on that. He just kind of says, you know, if we need to protect space assets, we're going to need infrastructure in cislunar space. And so the two efforts are in harmony. But he doesn't actually come out and advocate, yeah, we need a Space Force.
So I've been given an enormous amount of thought, and today I'm leaning toward having the Space Force, and there are two compelling reasons that I lean toward it. So first of all, we already have a very active space national security and defense force. It's managed by the Air Force. So the issue isn't whether we're going to have national security defense networks for space assets, both private sector as well as public sector. We're doing that. The issue is, would a separate space force do it better? And there's a couple of things, John, of why I'm leaning toward it. So number one, in the military, and by the way, the Air Force is not the only military branch that has space. The Army has the missile branch with the Redstone Arsenal down in Huntsville. And the Navy has an NRL and Naval Research Lab space assets. In fact, they're the ones that created timing for the GPS. So it is scattered throughout the service, but there isn't a space career path for military officers and highly trained enlisted people. And those of you who've been in the military, you know the phrase, the good of the service. So no matter what your duty station is or your rank or your pay grade, you go where the needs of the service take you. So you could have spent 5 years in the Space Command and be highly trained about, say, missile launches or something like that, rocket launches up at Vandenberg. And you could get a set of orders to take you to a fighter wing or a bomber wing or some other wing say at White Sands or in Ohio or something like that. Again, needs of the service. The second thing is that when the Air Force has issues with their budget, which they do all the time, the Air Force is fighter plane sensitive. That's, you know, their golden boy. That's what drives most of the Air Force and the leadership and all of that. So the Space Command ends up being robbed to some degree for funding to cover overlaps and problems in the fighter division and other divisions of the Air Force. So Space Command, as important as it is not as high a priority in the Air Force as are other things such as the fighter wing. So if you had a separate Space Force, number one, the people would have a career path. They would learn the space skills and be able to advance and get their ranks and their pay grades and stay in space, and those skills would not be lost at the cost of having been highly trained, which is expensive training, by the way. So you'd have continuity and career paths, and you'd have outlets for continuing to develop personnel expertise. And then the budget would not be raided to fund other branches of the military, unless Congress allocated less for Space Force and more for the Marine Corps, or however Congress might allocate that with a Space Force command. I think those are really big deals. So that is why today, let's see, at 12:45 California time, I'm leaning toward the Space Force. Now, there are issues about how efficient the Space Command has been, and I'm very concerned, and I think that if you had a Space Force, the same policy wonks and the same people would be making policy that guided the Space Force military branch, and it might be just as incompetent in missing things as it is now. For example, China and Russia having weaponized hypersonic transportation, and we do not. And if any of you saw the speech that Mike Griffin recently gave in the interview he gave on it, we don't even have radars that can detect fast-moving hypersonic missiles. And I have one of the authors, a really incredible space journalist coming on, Sandra Irwin, is coming on the show. She wrote one of the Mike Griffin articles about this, to talk about this. But that would have probably been a policy that was missed even with a separate Space Force, so I'm not sure anything would be more efficient unless you made changes in how policy and decision is made, and that really concerns me a lot, because other countries seem to be weaponizing space while we don't seem to be going in that direction, and hopefully nobody goes in that direction, but what do you do when China and Russia are going in that direction? So I know there are other people like Brian Whedon and others that speak adamantly against the Space Force, but those are my thoughts on it. But I have not seen Spoudis's article. Why don't you post it on the blog or send it to me, and I would appreciate that.
Yeah, I will. So question for you. You were in the Navy. So the Marines, they're a separate branch, or are they funded through the Navy? I just don't know.
They're a subset of the Navy, but they have their separate funding, but they are part of the Navy, and their mission is based on what the Navy does in support with them. So that's why their mission is a little bit different than the Army, and they work differently than the Army.
Okay, then why wouldn't a Space Force make sense to be similar to the Marines and the Navy? It would be part of the Air Force, but you know, get its own funding.
You know, I'm not the one to be asking because I'm by far and away not the expert on this, but I'm assuming to have the. And I'm willing to be corrected out there by anyone, okay? So, because I'm telling you up front, I'm anything but an expert on this. To be totally separate in your funding and to have a career path where you're trained in space, you stay in space, and you can become an admiral or a general in space and not be switched around, then I think you need to not be a subset of anything. You need to have your own branch of the service or your own entity. So the Marines can still be moved around, and they do have some space applications, and they serve in different space things, but then they're transferred back to their former military commands after they've done the space service.
Yeah, but isn't there a career path for Marines?
In space?
No, in the Marines. So,
but the Marines, I'm not the one to ask this. The Marines' career path is probably a little different than the Army because they're so closely related to the Navy, even how they fly fighters and close air support and things like that for their ground troops is heavily Navy influenced. So I just space is a unique field. So you're saying if the Air Force created a special subset for Space Command, would there be a career path within Space Command? It's awfully narrow.
Right.
Whereas the Marine Corps is not specifically that narrow. So I don't know. I honestly don't know, and I don't know if the Air Force would still be able to swipe some money from them from time to time. I don't know how that would work. I've not seen your idea seriously proposed as a counter proposal, for example. I'm not seeing anyone say, instead of a separate Space Force, let's just create the Space Force and separate it out as a separate command like the Marine Corps and the Navy. I'm not seeing that, although from time to time someone mentions it, as you're doing. I mean, someone in policy in Congress mentions it. But I don't see any traction with it, and I simply don't have enough of a background to tell you why the traction is missing. We might be able to Google it and after 15 minutes come up with the reasoning behind it, but I can't tell you what it is right now.
Yeah, well, I don't know what they would be doing, the Space Force now. I mean, there isn't a lot to do.
Well, now, see, here I disagree with you 100%, and I think this is a total misunderstanding, especially among space cadets. Remember, the Space Command right now is entrusted with the security and national defense of all of our space assets, military as well as private. So our economy is 100% dependent on space. 100% dependent.
Blind, oh, I agree.
Blind our satellites, our GPS satellites, we lose our economy. Okay?
Yeah.
North Korea blows a hydrogen bomb up over the U.S. high enough up. Maybe people don't get killed, but the EMP takes out our infrastructure. It's years before we could rebuild something like that. Our weapons systems are all smart now. And so if they get hacked, if they get jammed, all of that, and Russia and China are working to do that. And they also have anti-satellite programs. So the Air Force right now is already doing that. They're overwhelmed with it. And if you listen to Air Force people talk about it, they need more technology. They're behind, like on hypersonic missile detection. They need more revenue. They need more training. They need bigger forces. So it's not as if there isn't anything to do. Space cadets think it means you're going to go out there and protect a deep space mining camp on asteroid XYZ, way, way out there.
Exactly. That's
that maybe in 100 years, maybe in 50 years or 60 years, space will evolve. But that's not where the interest in the national security and the need lies. The need lies in keeping our economy going, our intelligence services, and keeping our assets going, and, you know, for warfighters and for our military, because, like it or not, it's space-dependent now. Now, you know, I talked about this once before on the show, or several times last year. The Navy has tried to come up with a method to navigate their ships if they lose GPS. And they found that their officers on the ships and the chiefs and the top petty officers no longer knew how to even use a sextant. Now, I've talked about this on the show, and they could not navigate a ship without the use of satellites. So the Navy, starting last year, or maybe it was 2016, started retraining line officers and key enlisted men that are on the line to navigate celestially and with a sextant in case they are blinded from space assets. I mean, it is a huge risk and problem. Now, there may be people outside the United States listening to this discussion and blowing it off and thinking, so what, you know, it's not a big deal and all that. But, you know, we're the ones that are keeping space open, kind of like innocent passage on the high seas. You know, when the pirate ships were coming after, you know, cargo ships and stuff, they put out for help. Any other military ship in the area from France or Great Britain, they would come to the rescue of any flagship, but it was the Navy that had most of the ships out there and most of the ability and the capability to reply to these guys. And, of course, the one case was really famous and got made into the movie. You know, keeping space safe, it's not for space stations in low Earth orbit or for LOPG, for example, or a lunar settlement, or we're going to go to Mars. It's about keeping our satellite and our infrastructure and our economy and our national security intact. The Air Force is already doing that. Could the Space Force do it better and more effectively? And because of those two reasons I cited, right now, today, I'm leaning toward the Space Force. But I understand it's a debatable topic with a lot of different perspectives. If I got Brian Whedon of Secure World to come back on the show, and he may be willing to do it, we'd have an earful of why none of this is matter, and it's all bogus, and we shouldn't do it. So that's the other perspective. And I'm leaning toward inviting Brian on for his perspective, even though, again, today, I don't agree with it, but maybe tomorrow I will.
Yeah, you provide a very compelling argument, and you know, the efficiencies across all the different branches of the military. You know, I mean, it's important that space gets the emphasis that it needs. I'm just concerned that it will become a funding sink. And, you know, if they take what, you know, the Navy, the Air Force, the Army, whatever, all they, you know, take that out of their budget and make one for the Space Force, then I'm with it. But, you know, it's going to be expensive. And, you know.
Well, let's talk about that for a minute. The estimated cost to establish the Space Force is an administrative cost of about $8 billion. Now, once that is incurred, the cost is what you're spending on the programs, which we're already spending now. So that would be taken from the Air Force and maybe some of the other branches of the services and consolidated, in the Space Force budget. So the more expensive is the administrative cost up front, and $8 billion is not something to trivialize. I wish I had it. And so now, does the Space Force do a more effective job in getting increased budgets for their work and their security and all of that? Maybe. I don't know the answer to that. But I suspect the operating cost for the Space Force and the program funding and creating the new tools and security tools and weapons and stuff like that would be comparable to it staying in the Air Force. So I think the added cost is the upfront admin cost to establish it. So when you're looking at cost benefits, I think pretty much everything is a quid pro quo, since we're already paying this money to the other branches and to the mm-hmm. and to the Air Force. Is it going to be a cost benefit plus to incur the $8 billion administrative cost to do this? So again, I'm right now today on the side that says yes, for the reasons I have suggested, and because I truly understand the risk, and I'm hoping, and maybe this is an unfounded hope, because this means I'm hoping for something good out of government, and everyone who listens to this show knows how cynical I am on government, but I'm hoping that a Space Force would be more alert to problems, and for example, wouldn't find themselves years behind the wheel on seeing China weaponize hypersonic flight, and we don't even have techniques to find it. So, I mean, that's disconcerting to me. What can I say? I mean, I'd ask Brian about that and see how he explains it. Could he convince me? I don't know. But Brian was an Air Force officer before he left the Air Force. I don't think he retired as an Air Force officer. But I did a show with him when he was in Cheyenne Mountain, and he got permission from his officers to actually do the show from within Cheyenne Mountain. That was the first time he was on the space show.
Wow. Okay, well, interesting discussion, David. I'll get off and let somebody else call in. Thank you.
Thank you. Listeners, one thing I forgot to bring up in the discussion part is, believe it or not, the much-talked-about, long-delayed One Giant Leap Foundation board meeting is going to be sent to the board members before I take off for Pasadena for the Mars Society conference. I mean, I'm really busting my chops to get it all done. And I'm almost there. I'm not there yet, but I'm almost there. And one of the action items in the board meeting minutes is something I've been talking about, and that is the revamping the Space Show Advisory Board. So I have proposed to the board of directors terms and requirements and guidelines for a new One Giant Leap Foundation advisory board. And I'm not going to tell you what I have proposed because I don't know that it will get approved by the four other members of the board. There's five of us on the board. And if it gets approved, I will obviously talk about it on an open line show. And I will also revamp the advisory board website page on OneGiantLeapFoundation.org to list the requirements for being on the advisory board. And then for people who want to be on it and who are accepted and who meet the guidelines, and basically I'm the one who's accepting, but I have to follow the guidelines that the board agrees upon, then they will be listed and identified as well. There won't be anybody anonymous. Let me say that. So that is forthcoming. I'm hoping that this will all be wrapped up by the end of September. That sounds like a pretty far away, but I will get the board meeting information out by the middle of this week, which is when I'm leaving for Pasadena, and then it will take people time to respond and deal with it and sign and return documents to me, either by scanning them or putting them in the mail to me. But it is in the works, and I know many of you contacted me before saying that they had an interest in the advisory board. Well, that is coming up, and I will keep you posted. But we're a whole bunch of steps closer. And I wanted to say that early on, but somehow I forgot about it. Anyway, we are available for more questions, and I notice we're at the top of the hour already. So if the phone doesn't ring real quick, I will take a break for 3 minutes and then come back, and hopefully more of you want to call. It is 1-866-687-7223, and I think I'll go ahead and take a break. If you do call, I'll answer the phone during the break, and listeners will be offline at for about 2 to 3 minutes. So don't go anywhere. And again, we want to hear from you, 1-866-687-7223.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of the Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. And welcome back, everybody. You are listening to part two of our program. I'm your host, David Livingston. In terms of sponsors for the second segment, I want to thank the Integrated Space Plan, which is the highly detailed development chart showing the path to becoming a spacefaring race, and you can see how technology and destinations build upon one another. Explore hundreds of individual elements in more detail at thespaceplan.com. You can buy your own copy of the plan. Again, go to thespaceplan.com. AIAA, the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, is a sponsor. They have over 30,000 individual members. Around 90 countries are involved, 95 to 100 corporate members. They're the world's largest aerospace professional society, and their members work in the field every single day. So check them out. Go to some of their events. Networking is outstanding. AIAA.org. And then Celestis is our sponsor. So Celestis remains the only proven pioneer of Memorial spaceflight services in the world. They are well known for launching a symbolic portion of an individual's cremated remains to space, and these include suborbital flights, orbital, lunar, and soon, deep space destinations. They have arranged to send more than about 1,500 individual flight capsules for people from more than 25 nations on affordable, environmentally responsible, and immensely meaningful space flights. And it's a great closure or a great meaningful ceremony. And I would urge you to look into it. You get copies of the launch video and other things back from them. Their missions include DNA samples from people and pets, micro SD cards containing messages, photos, even books, scientific experiments from elementary and high school students, and memento items, including religious items. They've even had diamonds and other things that people want to send to space. So if you're interested, you need to check them out. You can send your own DNA along with your loved one's DNA or ashes. And their website is Celestis.com. And remember, I am their customer. And very, very happy to be their customer. They're a great company to live with. Listeners, the reason I cut short the vision statement before I started the second segment is I keep forgetting that it is woefully out of date. It has my very, very old phone number on it that has not been current since late 2013. So I need to re-record the vision statements. There's two of them. One in my voice and one that was professionally done. I think one of them's in my voice. Anyway, if anyone out there does voiceover, has a exceptionally clear and really good voice for radio, and has recording equipment, because you can't just say, David, call me up on the phone and we'll record it over the phone. That'll sound like crap. I would be interested in talking to you about doing new recordings, digital recordings, for the vision statements that I play on the Space Show program, getting rid of the incorrect telephone information. I mean, that should be replaced. So if anyone's interested in doing that and you have the resume and qualifications and track record to back it up, and you have just an exceptional good voice to do that, man or woman, let me hear from you. Email drspace@thespaceshow.com. And we do have a caller with us. John Hunt is our first caller for the second segment. And hi, John. Welcome back to the show.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, what I was calling about was, I think it was some time back, there was some discussion of fusion got in there, and I thought that something ought to be addressed about it. And one thing is that, you know, most of the early generation projects on fusion, at least the official ones, the big budget ones, are all based on a tokamak primarily, and they require a tritium-deuterium fusion reaction, okay? And because tritium is not naturally occurring, it's essential that I think somebody's wondering why they're studying breeding with the ITR project. But that's absolutely essential if you're going to actually have a fusion reaction. You have to breed tritium in the reaction, and you have to probably breed more of it than you need for the specific reaction in order to set up the next reactor and the one after that. It has to be an expanding type of idea.
It's come up on several shows lately. Do you believe in fusion being just around the corner?
I wouldn't say around the corner. I mean, I think my attitude on fusion, which may be wrong, I'll admit that, is that the real holdback on fusion is that governments themselves are reluctant to pursue it aggressively. I mean, to me, it looks like the fact that we have to turn into an international consortium with all the delays that involves, rather than simply the U.S. having a project to really pursue it aggressively itself, to me, it just suggests, why are we doing it that way? I mean, you know, we spend incredible amounts of money on all sorts of things, and this is not really that big of a budget item, really, when you get down to it, actually.
Well, what about the little companies like Focus Fusion? By the way, Eric Lerner will soon be back on the show with his Focus Fusion update. Lawrence Plasmaville, or whatever he calls his company.
Yeah,
those guys?
Yeah, well, those are all in the category of other. And that there are other ideas out there, you know, and electrostatic fusion, there's a... some other, I forget what they called it, the thing that that was, was it EMC, was the name of the company was dealing?
Yeah.
Pollywell, I think that was it. That's a magnetic idea.
Pollywell,
And I think, and of course, I think Lockheed Martin has its project that they've given a little bit of publicity to, which I think, I don't know exactly what technique they're using. I kind of get the thing, it's kind of a mixture of the first two I mentioned. But whatever. But the mainstream ideas are still the other ones, and I think you need to be able, in those kind of reactions, you have to be able to also develop the technology of breeding the tritium as you go. And essential idea. You got two isotopes of lithium that are relevant here. The lithium-7 is the isotope that really leads to breeding, basically. Lithium-6 produces the tritium and helium, and then the helium then fuses with deuterium to create a reaction, and of course that's the basic fuel that's used for nuclear weapons, you know, the thermonuclear bombs, where you're not, you know, but for peaceful reactions you need to utilize the lithium-6 in order to produce the extra neutrons to breed the tritium that you're going to need. Because if you actually ever got this thing worked out, you'd have to have an expanding amount of tritium production in order to, you know, build new reactors and fuel them and so forth.
What about the work that's being done internationally on the ITER? You're not supportive of that?
Well, I am. I am. I mean, yeah, that's the big thing that's going on right now.
The only thing, that I know of, yeah.
But my question is, why did we go this way with it when we had the basis 20 years ago to say, hey, let's really create a national focus project and actually pursue it? I mean, you know, the U.S. government spends tremendous amounts of money on all kinds of projects that are, you know, that aren't as significant as this for energy production. I think that, that there probably is an answer to that, and it's, at least I have a theory on what it might be, but those two things driven. One is, obviously, this would cut into other sources of energy that are still politically powerful, right?
Right.
The other thing is, I did mention tritium and neutrons, didn't I?
Yes, you did.
And if you have those two items, you can do other things with them than creating peaceful energy.
Well,
And the question is, do you want to turn this loose on the world in an uncontrolled fashion? I think the governments may be saying, whoa, let's suck it now. As long as it's just a laboratory project, it wasn't going anywhere very fast, this is kind of cool, but, you know, maybe we better think about this.
Well, I don't know. I don't know if you could be guessing right there or not. I've not done a show or talked to anybody that says very much about all of this.
I've never seen anybody else address those that issue.
I mean, the only shows I've been able to do on this issue relate to what you call the category other, with the smaller companies that are involved. I've never gotten any mainstream fusion researcher on the show or anybody from ITER on the show. I have tried, although to be totally above board and honest, I haven't you know, like gone to the mat trying. But I have made some efforts with people at the University of Wisconsin over the year, and a couple of other places to do it. But the category others are much easier to get on the show.
Yeah, because they're trying to get publicity and
raising
funding for their projects.
Yeah, because they've all discovered crowdfunding. Like Eric has been very, very successful in crowdfunding programs for Focus Fusion and his work at Lawrenceville. So, and I think Polywell has also been successful. So it has been a big plus crowdfunding for the alternative fusion industry.
In fact, that latter is something I've not really heard any progress reports lately on how that's been doing in terms of actual results. They were claiming they were scalable, and given what they had, given a little money to push to the next level, they would be producing grand results, but I've not heard how that turned out.
Well, they don't always talk publicly. They're kind of sealed mouth, whether that's to be private and protect, and for reasons like that, or to the progress maybe isn't where they want to be, and they don't want to disclose that because that would probably injure future fundraising capabilities.
Well, you know, on the other category, a lot of that is what's generally referred to as aneutronic fusion, which is
right.
Some other elements, helium-3 ideas, or even, what's the other one, boron and hydrogen.
Uh-huh.
I think that's the most exotic of the possibilities out there. That's a whole different, you know, situation. And I don't know, there's different people, you know, I mean, talking. I guess if anybody succeeds in producing that on a smaller scale and has a patent on it, they could presumably make a lot of money.
If it's successful, and nobody, as far as I know, has even come close to commercial break even with any of this.
No, they haven't at this point. But again, what got me clued into my thinking I just mentioned was the fact that I can recall that they were making a lot of progress in the early 90s, and around there, somewhere abruptly, the government cut the fusion funding about 40%. And I was like, whoa, that's a reaction to good news as we cut the funding? That seemed to me to be kind of like that whoa thing that I was mentioning, that somebody went, you know, we don't want this to, you know. Because I suspect there are other, you know, and there's a lot of other energy industries that have their own, you know, priorities. Plus, I think that The latter is a real issue. If fusion becomes readily available on the world scene, you know, that's, you know, some things could be diverted, perhaps, you know, in various ways to produce other elements.
Well, depending on when it is actually commercially available, it could be very disruptive.
Yeah, I think that those are issues. And, of course, I'm also extremely interested in the idea of fusion for space propulsion, of course, naturally, considering, you know, my interests. I just thought I'd mention that I think that makes sense that they're interested in breeding the tritium, though, if they don't develop that technology. And, you know, there's a lot of complicated things in doing this thing, you know, I mean, you're trying to put this all together in one package, you know, with, you know, you have the superconducting magnets. On the other hand, you have a very hot plasma, a lot of neutrons, which most of the energy is 80% of the energy coming out of that's in the form of neutrons, you know. So a lot of, and there's an issue of things that the potential damage fast neutrons do to other materials in the structure. You know, so there's a lot of complicated stuff to do.
Changing the subject on you, any thoughts on the Elon Musk situation with you?
Well, I think, yeah, it sounds like that he made some public comments that perhaps were, you know, inopportune from the SEC point of view. I mean, there would be nothing wrong with him, you know, having a plan along those lines, but I think making the comment and having it affecting the stock market sort of sets off certain regulators to their natural behaviors, you know. So that could be a problem. I don't know if it's a critical one. I don't know whether he's really going to take it private. Does he really have or likely to have the financing to do it?
No clue. What about the indications, like from the New York Times article and others, about stress and mental things, and people saying he's near a breakdown, and on and on and on? I'm sure you see the same articles everybody else sees.
Of course, I have no idea whether that's actually the case. I mean, you know, I hope that's not the case. But, I mean, if he's really, it sounds like he's having some financial problems with Tesla and running it or something. That's the gist I'm getting, and that would be probably the source of the stress, right? I mean,
according to the New York Times article, he was saying if they could find a CEO to take over Tesla, he'd give them the position today. But he claims they can't find a CEO.
They can't find somebody to take on that job, huh?
I don't know. You want to do it?
Somehow I don't think the board of directors, I think they would be an investigation if they made that decision.
I'm not ruthless enough. Plus, I have no car in big corporation experience, but I'd get run over by everybody. You have to be a ruthless SOB to be in that position.
That would probably be what would happen to me, right? I'd get run over. But I don't think that's likely. But, I mean, there are a lot of CEOs out there and people that, you know, that might be willing to take on a challenging project for the right compensation package.
I don't know. It might be pretty hard to work within the structure of whatever Tesla's structure is, with Musk. Well, I don't know if he still is a controlling stockholder or not on Tesla. He may still be. I don't know.
What I would say, though, is that if it does shade my attitude toward the other topic we had, I called it last time, on the SLS and Orion and whatever else, that I really think it's a mistake to bet everything on SpaceX at this point for future human spaceflight. I mean, that's not to say that SpaceX may succeed in building this VFR and make everything NASA's doing wildly obsolete. That's possible, I guess, but does it make sense to bet everything on it like so many people seem to be willing to do? I mean, I think it'd be good to let both proceed in parallel fashion and see how it turns out.
Well, did it make sense to bet our economy and national security and defense on space completely?
Well, I don't know about that. You raise some very good issues, though. I mean, we're so dependent on GPS for weapon delivery, for navigation, and everything else. It would be a real, if that was disrupted, that would be a real fiasco. I mean, like, do our pilots even practice very much doing old-style bombing, you know? I mean,
I don't know. Airline that I read recently where they did a survey to see how many international airline pilots could do inertial navigation and celestial navigation if they didn't have GPS and all the digital readouts, and it was like none. So it's not just a problem with our Navy. It's probably worldwide, as we've moved all these really cool technologies and we're dependent upon them, and even the old-timers that knew how to do all of this stuff. I remember years ago in the 70s, Pan American, for those of you who remember the actual airline, not the failed TV show of a couple of years ago, had a big base in San Francisco. And the Pan Am base mostly handled going to Asia flights from San Francisco. And I knew, for whatever reason, I don't know how it happened, I knew a ton of Pan Am pilots. They actually had navigators on board the 707 and stewardesses. And back then you could call them stewardesses, and it wasn't sexist or politically incorrect or anything else. And I went out with a few of them, and I went scuba diving with a lot of them. We all went up to this place called the Bamboo Reef in San Rafael, California. And there were a lot of Pan Am crew members, both the pilots and the stewardesses, that like scuba diving, and we go on trips to Monterey and in other areas, you know, in northern central California, the Channel Islands off Santa Barbara. And the navigator was an especially good friend of mine, and he said that they were, and this is again with a 707, that they were off course most of the way to Honolulu from San Francisco, and they were constantly course correcting and taking readings and using, back then they had inertia navigation, which was just starting. And he said that they're, when they would fly to Honolulu, they meandered over a certain area of the sky because they were never ever 100% on course. And his job as navigator was to keep correcting that course to get them back on course so they could get to Honolulu. And all of those skills, all of that ended with the new navigation that came in, you know, in GPS. And I don't think they have navigators on board. I think they have a co-pilot, but I don't, even on a 777 or a jumbo, the few jumbos that are left flying, I don't think they fly with navigators. Maybe someone in the airline industry can correct me on that if I'm wrong. But I think that entire profession, again, this was a profession. You could be the navigator, you know. It wasn't the pilot or the co-pilot. It was the navigator. That entire profession, I think, has gone bye-bye.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm getting at. And it's if those systems were totally disrupted, That would definitely slow things down. I wonder if adversaries aren't also dependent on these analogous systems.
Well, yeah, they may not have been as dependent as we are, or they may have been quicker to the punch to have to not forget their skills. Michael Listener just sent in a note and said he thinks that celestial navigation is being taught again in the Navy, and yeah, I've been mentioning that since I think 2016 when I first found out about it, teaching them how to use a sextant again, and how to do this manually and take sightings and all of that. So the Navy and the Coast Guard are teaching that again. Whether the Air Force is teaching it for navigation on planes or not, I don't know. And I don't know if any of the airlines are cross-training their pilots to be navigators. I don't even know that in the newer design planes that you could navigate. I don't know if they have any equipment for that. But
probably not. I mean, they probably use...
we've made ourselves vulnerable. Did we have to do that? I mean, it certainly there were economic advantages and ease and lowering cost and, you know, doing things digitally a lot cheaper than doing things that are requiring human labor. So I understand how it all happened over the years, but now we find out how easy and vulnerable we are. With even high school kids can hack into these systems sometimes and play hell with them.
Yeah, well, I would think that they would have this stuff encrypted enough that I was amazed that that drone was seen to be deflected into Iran that time, and nobody really told us exactly how that happened, but I guess it's a secret, as you'd say. But
yeah, and Michael just subsequently said China's system is GPS reliant as well, but also works on MEO and GEO. So I don't know if the Chinese remember how to use slide rules and sextants and do all of that stuff either, but, you know, they've been navigating, since the beginning of time itself? So it's really within their culture to be able to navigate on the oceans and everything. So, but we are vulnerable. Does that make you support the Space Force or have an opinion on the Space Force since we're talking about it?
Well, again, I don't know. I'm not. The only thing I could say is it does seem like it sets up an administrative overhead thing, and I don't know that. I mean, is there really a phenomenon that the space assets are being squeezed by everything else? I mean, that's the thing I'm kind of wondering, seeing how dependent everybody else is on it.
Well, they get raided when the Air Force needs additional funding. So, isn't a space career path. When Henry Hertzfeld was on the show a couple of weeks ago, he was talking about raiding he's not the only one who has talked about raiding the Air Force budget, but he talked about the lack of a career path and how this was hurting it. But he wasn't ready to commit to the Space Force. He said there are very good reasons to have it, and he listed a couple, but there are probably other good reasons not to have it. Again, if I got Brian to come back on the show and talk about it, you'd have 90 minutes of reasons as to why it's not.
If we had a Space Force, we'd have to have their own command structure. We'd have to have a Space Academy, right?
Necessarily. But.
And how are we going to train their officers? And then we'd have real space cadets.
Absolutely. They'll put the Academy in Golden Gate Park in San Francisco. Of course, they'd have to clean up all the trash and the needles and the poop and everything that the people are doing. They couldn't have that in the Space Academy grounds. But yeah, we could and call it Starfleet Academy. How about that?
Something like that.
Wasn't that in San Francisco? Wasn't Starfleet Academy in San Francisco?
I think at least they seem to always be based there or something.
That's a good reason to have the Space Force. We can put the Space Force Academy in San Francisco, and we can live up to the image in the one world, unified, everybody's happy Star Trek series.
Well, I guess that means the elements of the Navy and the Army that are associated with this would also get transferred into this new service, I guess, as well as the Air Force.
Maybe. Again, Henry, when he was on the show, talked about this would be a consolidation of all the services, military forces. But how actually it would play out, I think part of the problem in getting support for this is the lack of sort of a cost-benefit analysis study by the administration, really detailing what would be involved and why it's needed. What's mostly been out there is the campaign rhetoric of it, but nobody has seen a real nuts and bolts breakdown of what's involved, why it's needed, things for people to analyze and study. I don't know if that exists. Henry certainly pointed to the need for that, but nobody seems to know if it's there yet.
Well, I think right now the Air Force Space Command also includes the actual maintenance and operation of the ICBMs as well as a NORAD type things. And
well, some of it is a Redstone Arsenal at Huntsville.
Yeah.
So,
the ICBMs are Air Force, and I think. Well, I'm just saying that I guess that would all go into this too. So it would be it'd be part of the whole. I mean, there's a big difference between who maintains them or the new organization that they have than who actually controls the Strategic Command actually controls both the naval submarine, fleet ballistic missile submarines, and the ICBMs and the bombers, I guess. But operation, but the maintenance of them is in the Air Combat Command for the bombers and it's an interesting organization they came up with after the Cold War, you know, when they abolished the Strategic Air Command.
Well, so that's why I think it would be really interesting to see how they break all this down and make a compelling case for it. I've not seen that yet.
But where did this come from? Is it really just some congressman and a
No, it comes from President Trump is pushing it.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I doubt he thought this up on his own. I mean, with all due respect, and I do respect, but I do.
I think that this has been something that he says is a long time coming, and he's been interested in it since the campaign days and before, and says that we really need to beef up our national security space defenses and intelligence
networks. Well, I agree with that.
You know, he's recognized the threats to all of this, and he's a big commercial space fan as well. And, he has latched on to the idea. I mean, it's been out there for decades.
Yeah, well, it seems like, I presume somebody's actually proposed that to him and he's adopted it. I mean, it doesn't seem like it's coming directly out of the DOD because the Secretary of Defense was kind of caught flat-footed and now he's kind of saying, yeah, yes, sir, you know, but
I don't know.
At least publicly.
If there's an individual out there or a group that is responsible for planting the bug in the president's mind, I don't know what it is. Maybe someone out there knows. So
I thought it was some congressman that was pushing this, though, probably on the armed services or something. You know,
I don't know.
I can't recall the name.
If anybody knows, they should share it with us. We'd be interested in hearing it.
Okay. Well, at any rate, I'm not against it. I just think I wonder if it probably won't happen this year, I guess, because the budget's already kind of going through without it, right?
So. Well, he wants to do it within 2 years, but Congress would have to approve it, and it's not going to get approved. And if the House goes Democratic, like all the pundits are predicting, it wouldn't be approved just because it would be a Trump idea. Just for general anti-Trump reasons, it wouldn't get approved.
We'd probably have a very contentious government in that case.
More so than now, probably we would.
Yeah, I think it'd be very contentious.
You know, who knows?
It's an interesting idea. I just don't know whether brand new service, that's there is a certain administrative aspect to it. And, of course, the services battle each other anyhow for budget, even as it is. I mean, The Navy Air Force competitions have been notorious over the years.
If I were younger and still in the Navy and they actually formed a Space Force, I would put in to be transferred to the Space Force. I'd even re-up or agree to stay in to get transferred into Space Force.
Well, what kind of uniform they'll have? I start thinking of these kind of details.
Maybe they'll take it from Star Trek. I don't know. Anyway, yeah. Anything else? Let's make room for somebody else.
I think that's about it for now. I just made the points I wanted to, anyhow.
Thank you, John.
Okay.
Listeners, if you would like to call us, John has hung up on himself. And the toll-free number, and I hope there are more of you who would like to call. One, I know there's a lot of you out there who don't, who really strongly oppose the Space Force. Where are you? Sound off. It's hard to find people who do support it. I want to hear from both sides. 1-866-687-7223 is our toll-free number. And email is drspace, drspace, @thespaceshow.com. And then if you want to use our blog, as Michael Listener has been doing, it is thespaceshow.com, all the way over to the far right to the upcoming show menu bar. Click on today's program. It is the first one, and that is our archive show, our archive page and our blog page. And you can post your comments or ask your questions there. And as soon as you hit send, I will get it and can respond to you. While John Hunt was on the phone, John Jossi sent in a note, and he did post to the blog for today's show the Paul Spoutis article that he was referencing during his call about the Space Force. So you can find that there, too, and not have to search for it. So, listeners, we've still got time for your call. I'm not seeing the phone ringing, so maybe everybody's run out of steam. I don't know, or maybe the topics weren't to people's satisfaction. You know what I'm missing on the Space Force? Not that I care a whole lot about their perspectives are what many of our allies think about a separate space force. So what does Japan think? What do European countries think? The UK, for example, and Germany. What do they think of a separate space force rather than the Air Force doing all of this? Do they care? Does it make a difference to them? If anybody has an opinion on that or knows anything about international reaction to creating a space force, please share it with us. But be factual. I mean, you know, if you're not being factual and it's just your idea, that's fine. Just tell us it's just your idea, okay? We have another call coming in, and my caller ID says that the caller is unknown. So let's do find out who it is. Good afternoon, caller. Welcome to the Space Show. Who are you? Where are you, please?
Hey, David. It's Mike Listener here in New Hampshire.
Hi, Michael.
How are you doing?
Okay. And you?
I just tuned in late and caught the last part of John's of John's call. You know, I think the last time I was on your show, I talked about the Space Force and basically said I don't have, really, kind of on either side and kind of standing in the middle. I'm really kind of still there. But, you know, as far as other, you know, what our allies think, I mean, I've been watching blog posts, and of course I follow a lot of people on different social media platforms, you know, from other countries, and more than anything, I've seen a lot of people using it as a platform to hyperventilate, you know, about, you know, basically, you know, U.S., quote, dominating outer space and taking that totally out of characteristic. So I think if there's really any, I haven't really seen any substantive discussion on a space force from other nations, but, I mean, I think a lot of other people in other countries are using this as a platform for criticism versus having a constructive conversation.
Well, and that's a problem here, too, because anybody who opposes Trump for whatever, how he breathes, the color of his hair, you know, whatever, they're going to hate the Space Force just because it's, mm-hmm. it's a Trump initiative. So are you getting facts from people, or are you getting their anti-Trump hate mentality, you know, from them? And that hate mentality is so widespread and, you know, so pervasive all over every place, including overseas, that unless one can carefully separate fact from prejudice and bias, it's pretty hard to distinguish. Now, I'm not saying you shouldn't hate Trump or you should not hate him. I'm not getting into that on the Space Show program.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think in my 72 years, and of course I guess we should discount maybe 15 or 16 of it when I was growing up, I've never seen such a charged, irrational media and Congress and press and groups of incompetence across the board as I have seen over the last 10 to 12 years. I cannot believe this all is happening in America. I'm still in culture shock.
Yeah, it's really ridiculous. And even in this discussion with the Space Force in particular, it's hard to have a debate because people have, you know, basically are shooting from ideological positions versus actually sitting down and looking and saying, well, what's this going to really entail, and asking questions, you know, and saying, hey, is this a good idea or is it not? Instead of get things that, well, this is dumb, or, you know, you kept comedy routine saying how stupid it is, and of course, every once in a while you'll get a very lucid conversation about it. I mean, immediately after the president announced the Space Force initiative at the signing of SPD-3, I mean, you know, all hell broke loose on the internet, and I think I found one article that actually, you know, was really, really cognizant, and it was from somebody who I forgot her name right off the top of my head, but basically she gave a very coherent, very lucid conversation about the Space Force, the pros and cons, and it was a very good article. I even saw a very good, well balanced article in Bloomberg a couple of weeks ago. That really, you know, was surprising because that tends to be a little bit biased, you know, to one side versus the other. But the conversation is out there, but you got to filter through a lot of garbage, and I mean, and a lot of it's just, you know, ideological and agenda driven.
Well, I would love to see a real study of the pros and cons of a Space Force so it can be analyzed. And is it worth incurring the administrative cost? And can it be efficient? I mean, look, I just told a friend of mine who I'm going to have a phone call with today at 4 o'clock that while I'm, as of today, still mildly supportive of the Space Force, I understand that if you have the same policy wonks in place, the same people in Congress, the same defense intelligence people, and they missed the Chinese and Russian hypersonic weapons development program. And and we chose, and they knew about it, and we chose not to weaponize hypersonics because we want to take the high road and not have weapons in space. And all of that is fine and dandy. I'm not being critical of that.
Right.
And all of a sudden, the weapons are being tested and will be online in a couple of years, and we are left without even a radar or a sensing mechanism to spot them. Now, what I've read is that they can't be spotted very easily because of their high speed from space. And so you know, the best way to spot them are LEO clusters. And Mike Griffin, who was interviewed by Sandra Irwin, and I asked Mike to come on the show and talk about it, and he can't do it now because of his government job. So, but I got Sandra coming on, and I think it's like November 7th or November 9th. September 7th or September 9th, to talk about all of this. He says we're probably going to have to rely on the commercial SmallSat constellations and CubeSat constellations, which are LEO, that can spot these things at 5,000, 6,000 miles an hour and give us ample, you know, warning time. But then how you interfere with them and intercept them at those speeds is a really big deal. And they're really high up. They're kind of like near space, and then they come back down. If you have the same people making policy, making decisions, and evaluating data for the Space Force that did this for the Air Force, and they screw up and miss things, what makes us think creating a Space Force is going to give us any better outcome? I don't know the answer to that.
I think a lot of it's going to be, you know, policy changes from the top down, basically saying, look, we need to focus on this area, you know, advise us. I mean, versus, you know, being less strategic restraint and more strategic looking forward and implementation as we move forward in this administration. That's not a political statement. That's just basically the way, you know, the way it is. And I think, you know, well, the Space Force is probably one very good big example. I mean, I think another big example is what happened this past week in Geneva at the at what's called Paros, and it's basically a space weapons thing that's been going on for off and on for a long time. And the Russian and Chinese started up again, with the Russians taking the lead, and they had this big meeting in Geneva about it, and the U.S. delegate came right in and basically trashed it. I mean, they just came right in and laid it all out, saying, you know, this agreement you're putting up is garbage. You know, if anybody's being aggressive, it's you're being aggressive, you know, promoting all these weapon systems that are basically, you know, offensive. And they basically, you know, the way I see it, they basically trashed the conference and, you know, put a stop to it. So, I mean, and that's something we haven't seen in a long time. Actually, Bill Gertz sent me I didn't realize that happened until Bill Gertz actually sent me a link to the Geneva consulate there, but the representatives in Geneva had their statement out there, and I was reading that, and he says, well, you got a comment on it, and I gave him a comment for the Free Beacon. But I think the way things are thinking now from the top down are different, so we're going to start looking at these things a little bit differently. A lot of people don't like it and continue not to like it just because of, you know, ideological and political posturing. But it's, you know, I mean, I think we're moving in the right direction, and that includes, you know, the areas like hypersonics. And I think seeing Mike Griffin actually in a position in the Department of Defense to actually create, you know, hey, reform is a bad word, but it's probably the only one I can think of. Reform, you know, the way these systems are brought onto line and actually acquired is probably a good thing too. And that's probably going to make a lot of other people unhappy naturally, but I mean, it's a step in the right direction. And this deals with your whole idea of the hypersonics as well.
So this was the June meeting, because I've got June 7, 2018, Conference on Disarmament.
That was in Beijing. That was kind of a preparatory meeting. A lot of fluff, basically.
So how do I find it, or can you send me the link or post it on the blog?
I can send you a link of the statement that Bill Gertz actually sent me.
Yeah,
and
please send
I read this. I was like, wow, I didn't know this was going on, and he asked me if I'd make a comment for...
Maybe I can find a guest to talk about it.
Yeah, actually, you know what? Mike, you're familiar with Bill Gertz, right?
Yeah, but I've never been able to get him to come on the show. I know
really?
Him. I know him a little bit, not very much.
Yeah, I mean, Bill and I exchange emails. Every once in a while, he'll come and ask me to comment on something. He can be a little bit fickle about things like that, but he's definitely a hard driver.
And he's a government guy, so we're going to get a particular slant. I don't know how free he is to talk freely.
He's a reporter. Bill Gertz.
Oh, I thought you were talking about, somehow I'm thinking Gerstenmaier. Never mind.
No, Gerstenmaier.
No,
Bill,
I know.
Bill Gertz.
I know. I'm probably too small for Bill Gertz. I've never met him. I've never tried to get him on. But do you have his contact information?
You know what? Let me see if I have it, but let me talk to him first.
You do a really good job in getting people to come onto my show that I think I never have a chance to get on, like Tory Bruno, and that now he's come on twice and he's just could not be more gracious. And you've got the head lawyer for the State Department coming on in a couple of weeks too. So,
Gabriel's a good guy. I actually had a chance to meet him. What was it? In June, down in D.C. at a small event, and just a really great guy, very intelligent, and very. I think you're going to have a good show with him. Unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to listen to it live because of my schedule, but I think you'll put. I think
well,
you'll do
if
a
you,
good
if
show
you have
for you.
Questions you want me to ask him, send them in advance, and I will. But send me the.
Okay, I won't put Gabriel on the spot on air like that. If I have something I need to ask him, I'll ask him personally.
Well, send me the Gertz information. And if you can contact him and ask him to come on the space show,
I can. You have a good track record
in helping me get some of these big guys. I listen to his reporting all the time. Somehow I thought you were talking about Gerstenmaier, and I thought, what the hell is Gerstenmaier doing with that?
I'll send you a link from the Geneva statement. And trust me, a lot of people are not too happy about that, you know, because of the way it was handled. I'll just say it because everybody knows it. When I read that thing, I cheered.
Finally, we're
talking to China and Russia the way we need to be
understand. If I got Brian to come back on the show, I'm sure he'd be, splitting hairs over our behavior with it, too.
Oh, God. Yeah, I'm not sure I want to go down that road right now. But anyways.
Let me ask you a question on the Space Force. I'm getting a sense that it is dividing up leftist versus conservative. Are you getting a sense of something like that? I don't think either side know very much about space. And even the space people that I've talked to don't know very much. They think that we need that he's talking about protecting space settlements, mining things for property rights, things of that nature. That they're really not getting it what space has come to mean for our economy and our national security.
Well, the biggest misconception is about dominance. What we mean when we say dominance, and this really upsets me a lot because I see it misused, and I see people saying, "Well, this is aggressive messaging," and this is, and then they try and put the Space Force into it. I mean, dominant the way, and I actually did a blog post. I actually entered something on my blog for the first time in about 6 months that I did something, but it was raining last Sunday. I couldn't go out and do photography, so I was stewing about some of the misconceptions about dominance and most importantly that T-shirt that said showed an American astronaut with a flag on the moon saying finders keepers. The way that was being used really upset me. So I wrote a blog post on dominance, and I'll send you the link for you to read it. It's pretty short and a little entertaining. I'm a little bit sarcastic every once in a while at it, but the idea of dominance, and I think I discussed this the last time I was on the show. I think it was back in July.
Right.
Is that dominance isn't about finders keepers and us taking away from everybody. It's about ensuring that access is there for everybody. In other words, So that's I kind of backed that up. I backed that up some with my in my blog post with some actual research that I did for that book chapter last year. So the whole dominance thing has been so misused. And it's being channeled right into the Space Force thing, saying, well, this is why the Space Force is bad. But a lot of these people who are, you know, bad-mouthing the Space Force and how bad it is are completely ignoring what China and Russia are doing.
Well, yeah, they'd be okay with Chinese values and culture in space or Russian values. I mean, to me, it's the same as the Navy protecting innocent passage in the
seas. And you know what? And that's I think it's the analogy I used back in July. It's about, you know, it's the same thing as the Navy.
Absolutely.
And, you know, it's one of those things. You know, the oceans are, you know, we also go out there to project force, and in a sense, I don't know how this Space Force thing is going to turn out, whether it's going to, we're going to have space weapons or anything like that, or whatever the hell a space weapon is. But, you know, bottom line is, I think fundamentally, and this has been, in my opinion, has been U.S. policy since even before the Outer Space Treaty, being first and getting out there is about getting out there and being able to say, okay, we're here first, now we can exercise our options on how this is used. In other words, the idea is, one, are we going to use this for, you know, military purposes, or are we going to use it for peaceful purposes? And I think what everything has shown, especially, you know, after the Outer Space Treaty and Apollo, is that dominance and, you know, being first has been about, you know, peaceful purposes versus, you know, non-peaceful purposes.
Well, right, and the track record certainly shows that because space has been open to all, and look at a number of countries and the participants trying to get to the moon and
mm-hmm.
other things like that. I mean, it is open to all. And so,
yeah, and I mean, and that's why, you know, when I see Buzz, and in my blog post, I have a picture of Buzz Aldrin standing with one of the shirt with that logo on it, you know, Finders Keepers, and that just bugs me, because that isn't what being first is about. That isn't what dominance is about. It's about keeping it open, so it's open for use for everybody, and even being used for national security purposes. So
absolutely, but that's not what we do anymore. We misunderstand, we mislead, we're incompetent.
That's the big thing, and I think that's one of the hard things they did at Geneva, was they basically came out and hit the Russian delegation right between the eyes, and her statement was strong. I mean, and I was like, I can't believe this.
Who is her?
Yep, I can't pronounce her name. She's Yablim Pro. Poblet, I believe her name is. I can't pronounce her name, but it's in the link. Very, very intelligent lady, and she delivered a very, very strong address. And like I said, it looked, in my opinion, it just torpedoed the whole conference. And like I said, I've been watching some of the interview, reading some of the interviews, and some of the quote what I call the usual suspects, and they're not happy about it. And that kind of tells me that. Good. It was very effective. So,
well, send us the information or post it on the blog, and if Gertz will do it, I'm open to it.
I'll send you the information. I'll email you a couple links and see what you want to put up on the blog. And
okay.
Let me see if I can. I'll email Bill tonight and see if he'd be interested in actually, you know, coming on to the show.
Okay. Talk to you soon. Thank you, Michael.
All right. Yeah. Bye.
Listeners, we are through with Michael. We're coming up on 2 hours, but if anybody else out there is still interested in calling on any topic, you don't have to talk about the Space Force. I'm actually surprised that the Space Force has dominated, there's that word again, today's program. I was not expecting that. I didn't think we'd really get any takers on it when I threw it out there. 1-866-687-7223 is our toll-free number, and would love to have you call in. If some of you know people who are very good at speaking and who are articulate and they have a particularly well-informed, now pay attention to well-informed, perspective on the Space Force, and you think they'd make a good Space Show guest, please email me the information to drspace, drspace, at thespaceshow.com, and let us see if we can get the person on the show, or better yet, if you know the person, introduce them to me, and maybe you can help get them to come on the show, because I'm interested in exploring all perspectives on this, and will absolutely follow up on your suggestions. So keep that in mind. And by the way, that's good for other topics too. You know, if you have people in mind that you believe would make a great space show guest, then let me hear from you, whatever the topic is, even if it's a topic that I've never heard of. Hey, let's go for it. So, but you gotta put it in front of me so I know that the topic is out there and that you have an interest in it. So it doesn't look like anybody is going to take me up on calling. I understand there's a 3-minute lag time before what I say ends up on the air, so I'll give it another couple of minutes to see if somebody wants to send us another email or if somebody wants to give us a call. While we were talking to Michael Listener, Mark from Petaluma did email me. I've asked him to call us, but so far, as I said, the phone hadn't rang. He said the space lobby had Trump's ear for the Space Force. So I asked Mark to support his statement and to tell us who or what the space lobby consists of, because I don't know. I know the private space community is not particularly supportive of the Space Force. So what is the space lobby? Who is part of the space lobby that he is talking about? And does he have any supporting documentation about the space lobby? So I sent him back that information request in an email. I've not heard back from him, and I was hoping he would call in. I asked him to call us, but so far he hasn't done that. But I'll read his email one more time. The space lobby had Trump's ear for the Space Force. Now, I know Mark doesn't support the Space Force, so but still, I'd like to know what the space lobby is, who it consists of, and what supporting documentation there is for that. And this goes for any or either side of the Space Force. I don't see the supporting evidence for what is being said. I don't want to just have rhetoric thrown out there and we're supposed to take it as the gospel because Joe Blow or Mary Blow or Sally King or Sally whatever said it. Let's work with evidence-based material, okay? Regardless of which perspective it is, evidence-based information and material is the way to go. So it doesn't look like I'm going to get any more phone calls. Michael Listener has sent me the links, and I'll see which of these I should post on the blog. And Michael, thank you for that, and thank you for your call. And by the way, Michael, I wanted to get our mutual friend in the UK, lawyer, whose book you promoted on the show a couple of weeks ago, on the show, but he has not answered any of my emails. So I'm wondering if he's okay, if he's been ill, if he's PO'd at the space show, or what's going on. I mean, I've sent him 2 emails with dates to consider. I'm amazed that I'm not hearing back from him. So I'm hoping all is okay, and I'm also hoping that he hasn't dropped his interest or gotten angry at something that happened on the show. Sometimes I understand I can be a jerk, so hopefully I have not done anything to offend him, but I would like him to come back on the show about his book. So I just throw that out there, Michael. I meant to mention it the next time you were on the air. Listeners, I don't think we're going to get any more takers, so I want to thank everybody who has called in today, and also I want to thank everybody who has emailed in today. Do remember, I'm looking for a voiceover person to redo my break comments that have a bad phone number in it. So if you are such a person or you know such a person with an absolutely spectacular voice and has some recording equipment or some way we can do it other than just over the telephone, do let me know about that. And your suggestions for guests are always available and are always of interest, so we want to hear from you. So again, tomorrow, Brent Sherwood and 2 other JPL guests are on our show. We're going to be talking about LOPG or the Gateway and possible using it as a platform for artificial gravity. and some other things. So if that interests you, tune it in. Then remember, I'm off to the Mars Society. And I will record the interviews with Dr. Woodward and Dr. Fern and Dr. B. I may also do a tape-recorded interview with Dr. B. He is presenting a paper at the Mars Society. So I am going to attend that on Thursday, and I may sit down with him and do a tape-recorded interview with him separate from Dr. Woodward. We'll see. Dr. Doug is presenting multiple papers at the Mars Society Conference. Unfortunately, many of them are on Thursday, and I won't be there on Thursday. I'm sorry, on Friday, but I won't be there. As I'm going down to Woodward, Michael Listener is telling me he's interested in voiceover. Michael, I didn't think of your voice as a compelling voice. I'll have to think about that. Maybe you'd kind of be like a James Earl Jones, Darth Vader type of voice. Cool. Okay, listeners, your suggestions on that are also welcome. Michael, do you have any actual recording equipment where you can actually make a really good recording? Again, not over the telephone. All right, listeners, I appreciate your support for the show today. Thank you again for your calls and emails. Everybody have a terrific week, and I will be doing email while I'm at the Mars Society. And also, if you are attending the Mars Society Conference and you want to try to meet up, email me and tell me you're going to be there, and I'll give you my cell phone so we can maybe text one another and plan a way to meet on either Thursday or possibly Saturday while I am there. Have a great weekend, what's left of it, and have a terrific week coming up. And as always, keep looking up and keep it safe. Goodbye from the Space Show.